Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. China's president arrived in South Africa Wednesday for a state visit and a two-day China-Africa forum expected to bring about billions of dollars in investment deals. This is part of the arrival ceremony for the Chinese president. South African officials are quick, meanwhile, to point out that this is not President Xi Jinping's first state visit to South Africa. It's a fact that highlights the importance of the relationship between the two nations. South Africa is, after all, China's biggest trade partner. The two nations are also members of the increasingly powerful economic bloc known as BRICS for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Xi comes to South Africa after a day-long visit to neighboring Zimbabwe, where he met with his counterpart, Robert Mugabe. In the coming days, President Xi will meet with other African leaders in Johannesburg for a forum on Africa-China relations. At least seven people, including a police officer, were killed overnight in separate incidents in Burundi's capital and the surrounding area, according to police and witnesses, as well as an official Wednesday. In one incident, one police officer was killed and four others wounded in clashes with gunmen overnight, according to police. In a nearby Jabe neighborhood, police say the body of a man was found, killed elsewhere, and his corpse dumped in the district. Cameroon says its troops have killed 100 Boko Haram militants and freed 900 captives that were held by the group. The defense ministry says soldiers killed the militants and rescued the hostages during an operation last week along the Cameroon-Nigeria border. However, there's been no independent confirmation. VOA News. The French Interior Minister says three mosques have been shut down in France since the Paris attacks as part of a crackdown on extremist activities. This is Bernard Cazeneuve. He spoke to reporters and saying it was the first time mosques are being closed in France on grounds of radicalization. One of the mosques is 35 kilometers east of Paris and was targeted by raids early Wednesday, with police seizing a 9-millimeter revolver, a computer hard disk, and jihadist propaganda. Cazeneuve said the mosque also had a non-authorized Quranic school. One person was placed in custody following the raids, with 22 others banned from leaving France. Nine others were put under house arrest. Two other mosques, also in the Paris region, were shut down last week amid a state of emergency. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said Wednesday the Iraqi government was briefed in advance of Defense Secretary Ash Carter's announcement that teams of U.S. special operators could be in Iraq in a matter of weeks. The Specialized Expeditionary Targeting Force will consist of approximately 200 Special Forces personnel. The Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi praised his forces in a statement Tuesday and said that while Iraq welcomes support from its international partners, it does not need foreign combat troops on the ground. British lawmakers Wednesday are debating whether to approve Prime Minister David Cameron's request for the country to take part in airstrikes against the Islamic State group in Syria. Cameron appeared in Parliament to make his case Wednesday, saying the airstrikes would be a part of a wider strategy.
This is an ISIL-first strategy. They are the threat. They are the ones we should be targeting. This is about our national security.
You can read more details on that story at voanews.com. Participants at the United Nations Climate Change Summit outside Paris are discussing resiliency Wednesday, exploring the impact of natural disasters on the world's most vulnerable populations. The UN notes that natural disasters affect not only the economic dimension, but also the social and environmental ones, affecting 217 million people every year. Wednesday's sessions focus on oceans and water resources. The heaviest rainfall in over a century caused massive flooding across the Indian state of Tamil Nadu, driving thousands from their homes, shutting auto factories, and paralyzing the airport in the state capital of Chennai. That's the sound of a motorboat making rescues. The National Weather Office there is predicting three more days of torrential downpours in the southern state of nearly 70 million. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Hayes Wuhib. And coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
China's president arrives in South Africa Wednesday for a state visit and a two-day China-Africa forum expected to bring about billions of dollars in investment deals.
That's VOA's Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg. Details coming up.
Also in the news, China's president arrived in South Africa today for a state visit and a two-day China-Africa forum expected to bring about billions of dollars in investment deals. And several die in twin suicide attacks in northern Cameroon last night.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Hungary's prime minister claims Germany has authored a secret pact to bring up to 500,000 Syrians from Turkey into the EU. Viktor Orban said today the agreement will be exposed soon. Mr. Orban has led political opposition to the migrant crisis and sealed Hungary's borders to migrants. The Greek migration minister says EU officials threatening to withhold visa-free privileges called charges not fair. Greece has been the frontline point of entry for the vast majority of refugees from the Middle East and Africa. Luxembourg Foreign Minister Jean Asselborn has conveyed a suspension warning on a visit to Athens this week. Some Central European officials, most prominently Slovak Minister Robert Fico, have suggested excluding Greece from the EU's Schengen agreement granting free passage among EU states. Macedonian troops fired tear gas and stun grenades at Pakistani migrants trying to cross the border from Greece today.
The human rights group Amnesty International says some European countries are rejecting asylum applications from Eritrean refugees despite evidence that they face imprisonment and torture if they are forcibly returned to the country. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Eritreans are the third largest group of refugees arriving on Europe's shores after Syrians and Afghans. Stefan Simanowicz of Amnesty says the vast majority are young men fleeing oppressive national service.
Children from the ages of 17, 16 are forced into conscription. It's meant to last 18 months, but in reality can go on for indefinite periods. We spoke to people who had left after being in conscription in national service for 10, 15 years, others who'd had family members conscripted for over two decades.
A UN Commission of Inquiry earlier this year described Eritrea as one of the world's most oppressive regimes. The Eritrean government denied the accusations made in the report. Amnesty says the conscription amounts to forced labour, and anyone trying to evade or escape it is detained in appalling conditions.
If they are seen or caught, they can be shot and killed, they can be arrested, they can be tortured. Many of them are locked up in cells, underground cells, or in shipping containers for long periods as punishment for trying to avoid conscription.
Amnesty says the same fate would likely face Eritreans who had fled overseas but then forcibly returned. Despite this, some European countries, including Britain and Denmark, have begun rejecting the majority of Eritrean asylum applications. The British government changed its advice in March, claiming that Eritrea is safe for migrants to return to after leaving illegally. Simanowicz says they must change course.
The situation for Eritrean asylum seekers is a desperate one, and they must be given safe haven.
Speaking at last month's EU-Africa Migration Summit in Malta, French President François Hollande said the Eritrean regime must be confronted.
Avec l'Érythrée, il faut mettre une pression maximale, parce que ce qui s'y passe est extrêmement grave.
He said the world needs to put maximum pressure on Eritrea because what is happening is extremely serious. Nobody is talking about it. It is a country that is becoming empty of its own population. Despite Britain and Denmark's approach, Eritrean refugees were among the first to be relocated from Germany to Spain under the European Union's new migrant plan. Each European country sets its own rules on asylum. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
United States is a top choice for refugees and others seeking a new life far from war, oppression, and other instabilities. Once they get to the U.S., refugee children face the challenge of learning English and attending an American school. In New York, a six-week program called the Refugee Youth Summer Academy helps children from dozens of countries to succeed in the vast public school system. It's a process documented in the new film Refugee Kids, One Small School Takes on the World. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Sarah Rowbottom of the International Rescue Committee, which sponsors the academy, about the role education plays in helping refugee kids adjust and flourish.
Education is important not only to us, a value that Americans place a very high value on, but also something that refugees themselves place an incredibly high value on, and a real source of stability and something that's going to help them to regain that control over their future. Our students will be entering the public education system. However, that system is incredibly complicated. There are many layers, especially here in New York City. Our students may have had the benefit of a strong education, or they may have been educated in a refugee camp, or they may have been in unstable urban settings. Their educational experience of a head start on what that's going to be like. And that student is then going to raise their hand during the first week of school, rather than waiting 3 months or 6 months to do. Experience is rarely similar to what they will experience when they enter school in the United States. So it's really essential that we give them a little bit of that. It welcomes them into the school system rather than dropping them into this very overwhelming, not always that friendly environment.
Tell me a little bit about the school itself now. What was the impetus for creating the school? How was a refugee as a term understood? Was this just anybody who arrived, people who've had to have suffered some kind of an oppression or violence to get here?
The academy serves refugees, asylees, and other immigrant youth who have been affected by crisis. They're students that we are resettling ourselves, the International Rescue Committee. They're asylees who are being referred to us by other organizations, by schools, or actually by families through word of mouth. The school was created along with other youth programs in New York City in 1999 when there were refugees fleeing the former Yugoslavia. All of a sudden there was a large population of young people who needed educational support. And so a variety of youth programs developed to support those youth. The demand for those services has never gone down. The impetus behind the school is really to provide that extra leg up and that head start to develop or maintain a positive attitude towards school. Many of our students come very highly motivated and with a really positive attitude towards school. But the reality is that English language learners in New York City graduate at, you know, maybe 35% to 40% compared to proficient students, which is closer to 65%, 70%. That's a big gap that we have to take into consideration and help them to access needed services, acclimate in a positive way, and have an experience of success during the summer so that they know what that success feels like. So then when it starts getting hard, they've already tasted success, and that's going to help to drive them further. Most of our students are very, very strong individuals who have a lot of resiliency, and we need to tap into that and teach them how to keep tapping into that so that they're going to be able to do that in not only in the year ahead of them, but all the years that take them towards graduation.
Things are changing a little bit now. I mean, there's been a lot of talk now, obviously, about the Syrian refugees, and now since the Paris bombings, things are shifting again. Looking forward, what do you think is going to be the fate of these Syrian refugees sort of overall with respect to the school, to make a dent?
We have resettled Syrians before. We'll continue to do so. Syrians, their lives looked a lot like our lives before it was disrupted by this political crisis. They had jobs, they had families, their children attended school. But as children begin to arrive in New York City and their families are resettled, they're going to be very successful.
One of the things that I find so challenging and potentially very exhilarating is the similarity and the differences between the refugee children that come from some completely different kinds of places, but there are some commonalities, aren't there?
Absolutely. There are commonalities in the types of challenges that they have faced in coming to the United States. As you saw in the film, many of their families were separated for 5 years, 10 years, and they go through this process of having to get to know each other again and to reestablish the roles in the family. There are many challenges that are happening inside and outside of school that these students are going to share. There's the challenges for families who arrive intact. There are a lot of new, you know, power dynamics and things that are taking place as children acculturate typically faster than their parents, and they gain information and they're starting to learn how to use that information to their advantage. The students, no matter where they come from, they will negotiate these similar types of challenges. And I think you can see in the film, they really bond over that. There are friendships that are made at the Summer Academy. They're a lifetime friendship.
That was Sarah Rowbottom of the International Rescue Committee. She spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
A general in charge of a Libyan government force in the eastern city of Benghazi was killed by a roadside bomb today. Colonel Ali Al-Toman was killed by a mine in nearby Sidi Faraj. The Tobruk administration has been trying to drive Islamic State forces out of the region for several months. UN experts say the Islamic State has at least 3,000 followers fighting in key locations in Libya. Eight experts appointed by Secretary General Ban Ki-moon reported their findings to the UN Security Council yesterday. Libya is divided into various political and tribal factions since the overthrow of longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi in 2011.
As many as six civilians died in twin suicide attacks in Waza, a city in northern Cameroon, last night. Security officials said a third bomber was shot and killed before she could detonate her explosives. Cameroon has been targeted by Boko Haram for more than a year. Government forces have joined four other Lake Chad Basin neighbors to combat the six-year reign of terror that has killed more than 20,000, mostly in northeastern Nigeria. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The human rights group Amnesty International says some European countries are rejecting asylum applications from Eritrean refugees. A general in charge of a Libyan government force in the eastern city of Benghazi was killed by a roadside bomb today. And as many as six civilians died in twin suicide attacks in Waza, a city in northern Cameroon yesterday night. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
As the United Nations Climate Summit continues in Paris, among the issues on the table is the divide between rich and poor countries, with the poorer, more vulnerable countries saying the wealthy should pay for adaptation to climate change. As VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports, huge investment projects are speeding ahead in Africa, where economic and agricultural development could be on a collision course with the environment.
The population in Africa is expected to nearly quadruple this century. This creates an unparalleled urgency to produce more food. At the same time, the continent is rapidly opening up to extensive mining, largely driven by foreign money.
Because of all that, there's these gigantic proposals for creating roads, highways, railroads, major projects that are going to penetrate into often remote interior regions of Africa.
William Lawrence is director of the Center for Tropical, Environmental, and Sustainability Science at James Cook University in Australia. He says these development corridors, which on average are between 1,000 and 4,000 kilometers long, would have an enormous impact on the continent.
They crisscross Africa. They would total 53, more than 53,000 kilometers in length, And they just look like a giant spider web laid over the top of Africa.
But he says no overall plan or strategy exists to coordinate the many players, both foreign and domestic. In a study published in the journal Current Biology, Lawrence and his team assessed 33 major projects, either proposed or already underway. The assessment accounts for human population, agricultural potential, and environmental values, including biodiversity, endangered species, and critical habitat for wildlife and vegetation for storing carbon.
There was about six of the projects that looked like they were a pretty good idea, in the sense that they were going to yield a lot of agricultural benefits and not huge environmental costs. And then there was another six that I would take off the board immediately, that we're going to go slice into the heart of some of the most environmentally important areas of Africa, such as the Congo Basin and West African forests and some of the really critical equatorial and sub-equatorial forests of East Africa, places that are amazingly rich in wildlife and environmental resources.
The other projects fit somewhere in the middle. Lawrence advises caution moving forward. He says what may appear to be a great deal up front may turn out to yield unintended consequences. Take, for example, a large mining operation.
Limited numbers of people get really wealthy, and there is some more employment. But oftentimes what you find is there's still large segments of the population that are having to deal with everything suddenly, you know, food, rent, everything's becoming a lot more expensive, and they're not getting much benefit from it at all. So you're actually increasing the economic disparity. You get the pillar of the economy, which is mining, which swells and becomes huge, but the other pillars of the economy, all these other sectors, become shrink down and become less and less important.
Lawrence calls for local and national studies that can direct governments to deploy mitigation measures and environmental safeguards that will assure a more positive future.
And if they're not in place, you can get runaway deforestation, you can get huge increases in poaching, you can get giant collapse of wildlife populations, you can get loss of tourism revenue.
Lawrence says the time to act is now, before the projects gain a momentum that will be impossible to slow. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
China's president arrived in South Africa today for a state visit and a two-day China-Africa forum expected to bring about billions of dollars in investment deals. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
South African officials are quick to point out that this is not President Xi Jinping's first state visit to South Africa, a fact that highlights the importance of the relationship between the two nations. Here's Clayson Monyela, a spokesman for South Africa's foreign ministry. He spoke to VOA News from Pretoria, South Africa's capital, where President Jacob Zuma is hosting the Chinese president.
The state visit by President Xi to South Africa is a very important visit. As you know, he's only been in office for less than 2 years, and already he's visiting South Africa for the second time on a state visit. That's quite unprecedented, and it speaks volumes about the strategic nature of the relationship between South Africa and China.
South Africa, after all, is China's biggest trade partner in Africa. The two nations are also members of the increasingly powerful economic bloc known as BRICS, for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Xi comes to South Africa after a day-long visit to neighboring Zimbabwe, where he met with his counterpart, President Robert Mugabe. The two governments signed 10 agreements, including a $1 billion thermal power expansion project, according to Reuters. In South Africa, there is also a lot of money on the table, Monyela says.
There's a number of agreements and deals that are being concluded, worth billions and billions of dollars, which we believe will make a contribution towards growing the South African economy and assist us to deal with the triple challenges of poverty, unemployment, and eradicating inequality. So it's quite an important state visit.
But China's Commerce Ministry recently admitted that Chinese investments to Africa had fallen by 40% in the first half of this year, a move that some analysts attributed to China's slowing economy. Others, however, say it is more related to Beijing's changing approach to investments overseas. South Africa says they aren't seeing that, though, and that trade between the two countries rose more than twofold from 2009 to 2013. In the coming days, President Xi will meet with other African leaders in Johannesburg for a forum on Africa-China relations. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
As tobacco sales fall sharply in high-income countries, the industry has turned its attention to the developing world. In fact, a new study says people in poor countries are exposed to more intense and aggressive tobacco marketing than those in richer nations. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The study compared the levels of tobacco marketing since 2005. That's when the World Health Organization Framework Convention on Tobacco Control took effect. Some 180 countries have signed it, including 14 of the 16 countries in the new study. Those that have signed it are required to adopt strict tobacco control measures, including marketing bans. The study, in the bulletin of the World Health Organization, warns of a looming threat to people's health in low-income countries if steps are not taken to rein in tobacco marketing. Professor Anna Gilmore is director of the Tobacco Control Research Group at the University of Bath in the UK and one of the authors.
We looked at levels of tobacco industry marketing in 462 communities across 16 countries at different levels of development.
She explains how tobacco marketing was measured.
First of all, we used a standardized 1 kilometer walk around all of these communities to observe the number of tobacco adverts and the number of stores selling tobacco and whether the stores sold single cigarettes. And single cigarettes are really important because under the Framework Convention, which is the world's first treaty on tobacco control, sale of single cigarettes is outlawed. The reason they're outlawed is actually a really key way of getting cigarettes to young people because young people often can't afford to buy a whole pack, so they prefer to buy in singles.
A second measurement was done by asking adults to report their exposure to tobacco marketing over the previous 6 months.
We measured 13 forms of marketing, so whether they'd seen posters or television ads or radio ads, print ads, ads in the cinema, as well as sponsorship, marketing on the internet, and so on.
Gilmore says tobacco marketing was much higher in developing countries.
So on our community walks, we observed 81 times more tobacco adverts in the low-income country communities than in the high-income countries. People also reported way higher exposure to cigarette adverts in the lower-income countries. So they were 46 times more likely to hear radio adverts, 11 times more likely to see poster adverts, and 9 times more likely to see television adverts. And overall, those living in low-income countries were almost 10 times more likely to report exposure to at least one form of what we call traditional marketing than people living in high-income countries.
Traditional marketing includes radio, TV, and newspapers. Past studies have shown that the more adolescents are exposed to these advertisements, the more likely they will smoke when they're adults.
The industry's documents that it was forced to release through litigation make it absolutely clear that it targets children with its marketing. So one of our key concerns is that with this level of marketing, what the tobacco industry is doing is still trying to recruit children into smoking.
She says implementing anti-tobacco laws is very difficult because of the tobacco industry's legal and financial resources. She rejects claims that tobacco taxes would help a developing nation's economy, citing a World Bank report to the contrary. Gilmore adds that bribery allegations have been leveled against some companies for allegedly trying to derail laws. The University of Bath professor says it's projected that tobacco will cause 8.4 million deaths by 2020, with 70% of those deaths in developing countries. A number of illnesses are linked to tobacco use, including cancer and cardiovascular disease. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports features and more coming up next right here on The Voice of America. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, after nearly 2 years of fighting the Ebola pandemic, Sierra Leone announced last month that the nation was Ebola-free. Guinean officials have declared that they will also soon be free of the virus. Join us Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Chaka Sali and his guests discuss the battle to completely end Ebola in West Africa. That's next time on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. China's president arrives in South Africa today for a state visit and a two-day China-Africa forum expected to bring about billions of dollars in investment deals. And as many as six civilians die in a twin suicide attack in Waza, a city in northern Cameroon, last night. Coming up, we'll have music from Rwanda. And in our feature segment, generating private sector interest in bringing new technologies to some of the world's most desperate people. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Spuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off today in Senegal.
Kim, let's kick off in Senegal's coastal city of Embor, where action is continuing at the CAF Under 23 Africa Cup of Nations football tournament. Remember, VOA football fans, this competition doubles as an Olympic qualifying event. The top three African teams in Senegal will book tickets to next year's Olympic men's football tournament in Brazil. So that means the third place match on December 12th in Dakar, which is traditionally a forgotten affair, will have added importance. And the final will also be played on December 12th in Dakar. In the first match this evening in Embor, Algeria is meeting Mali, and that will be followed by a game between Egypt and 1996 Olympic champion Nigeria. In their opening matches Sunday, Nigeria defeated Mali 3-2, and North African rivals Egypt and Algeria played to a one-all draw. In action Tuesday, host Senegal advanced to the semifinals. The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma has that story, as well as basketball and Olympic news.
Hosts Senegal dismissed Tunisia 2-0 to become the first team to qualify for the semifinals at the Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations in Dakar on Tuesday. In the other Group A tie, South Africa pipped Zambia 3-2. Today, Wednesday, attention shifts to Group B in Emboa, some 70 kilometers southeast of Dakar, where Algeria play Mali before Nigeria engage Egypt. In basketball, Nigeria's Dolphins outplayed Burundi's Berco Stars 105-75 at the Africa Women's Club Basketball Championships in Luanda, Angola on Tuesday. Angola's Primeiro de Agosto outclassed the Democratic Republic of Congo's RADI 82-36. Cameroon's INJS edged Angola's Makoluso 55-51. Nigeria's First Bank outwitted Kenya's United States International University 89-63, and Mozambique's Ferroviario de Maputo prevailed over the Democratic Republic of Congo's INSS 68-57. In Olympic news, citizens of the German port city of Hamburg voted in a referendum by 51.6% to reject the city's bid to stage the 2024 Olympics and Paralympics, according to the International Olympic Committee president Thomas Bach, who is German. The vote has been influenced by budgetary concerns, the scandals around Germany's award of the 2006 FIFA World Cup, recent doping scandals, and a growing refugee crisis in which Germany expects 1 million refugees to enter the country by the end of this year. The other cities still in the running to host the 2024 Games are Budapest in Hungary, Los Angeles in the United States of America, the French capital Paris, and the Italian capital Rome. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Joining us once again on the VOA is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sonny.
David, let's turn our attention to Europe now. And any recent African goal-scoring highlights?
Well, Sonny, every time we come to Europe, one name immediately pops up, and that's Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, 26 years of age, Gabon striker and superstar. He plays for Borussia Dortmund in Germany, and he scored another two at the weekend, and that's now 17 goals in 14 Bundesliga matches. He has scored in 12 of those 14 matches. Only two league games in Germany this season that Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang has not scored. And in all competitions, Sonny, that raises his tally now to 25 goals. That includes the Bundesliga, the German Cup, and the Europa League. Another player making waves in Europe, and it's a name we are mentioning more and more frequently on The Voice of America, is Odion Ighalo. He's a Nigerian who plays for Watford. He was on target again, his eighth goal of this season, and it was very important because it gave Watford a 3-2 away win at bottom club Aston Villa. Now, Watford were promoted for this season, Sonny, and I think a lot of people felt that they were going to languish right down there at the bottom. But it's, in fact, turned out the other way around as far as those two particular clubs are concerned. Villa, who for some seasons now have stayed just above the relegation zone, are now rooted to the bottom. They're, in fact, 5 points behind the second last team, which is Newcastle United. And Watford, on the other hand, they are picking up a significant number of points. And at this stage, although it's just about a third of the way through the season, you would have to say that they have got a reasonable chance of avoiding the drop. And in their first season after being promoted, make no mistake whatsoever, the primary target of Watford and other clubs like them will be simply to survive. There is so much money, Sonny, in the English Premier League, and the Championship, which is the second tier of club football, pales by comparison. So that is priority number one. You find quite often that clubs like Watford, they will field their reserve team in things like the FA Cup and the League Cup. The Premier League is priority number one. And if they are going to stay up, it looks like a key figure will be Odion Ighalo, the Nigerian.
David, still with African players, they're noticeably absent from a 55-player shortlist for the FIFA Pro World 11, which is voted on by professional footballers. How about some details, David?
Yes, Sonny, I'm seriously puzzled. They have named 15 forwards, and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang cannot find a place among them. I'm not suggesting Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang is going to make the final 11, when you think of the likes of Ronaldo and Messi and Neymar, they're the guys who are going to fill those slots. But I do believe that in naming your 55 best players on form, and I think that's a crucial point, on form, Aubameyang should have been among them. Now, people might say, well, that's fine, David, but who are you going to drop? And I've got no hesitation, Sonny, in looking at this list and saying, why is Wayne Rooney of Manchester United there? Now, the Johannes newspaper that caught my eye recently, they had the FIFA Pro list at the top of the page. And directly below that, they had a story about the abysmal current form of Wayne Rooney. Now, I'm the first to acknowledge that Wayne Rooney at his best is an outstanding footballer. But the point is, at the moment, he is anything but outstanding. And no less a person than Roy Keane, a former superstar at Manchester United. He's now the assistant coach of the Republic of Ireland team. He's got some interesting points to make. He said mentally, he doesn't, referring to Rooney, look really sharp. Physically, he doesn't look in great shape. He needs to have a look at himself. He looks awful. Oh, Sonny, that's pretty powerful words coming from Roy Keane. Roy Keane, on the field, a really tough man, a midfield enforcer, and off the field, he's not somebody who shies away. He shoots from the hip, I think, Sonny, is the cliche. And that's good enough for me. And I'm really astonished that the professional footballers all around the world would rate Wayne Rooney on current form higher than Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. Aubameyang is banging in goals. The Bundesliga, let's put it into context, is arguably the third best league in the world after England and Spain. I would actually put Spain on top, followed by England, and then next I would put the German Bundesliga. And this is a guy who's been scoring with great consistency, and sometimes it's two goals in a game. At one stage of the season, he scored hat-tricks in consecutive matches. That, for me, Sonny, is the sort of form that deserves a place among the 55 nominees for this World 11.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. David mentioned a few of the clubs in the English Premier League. Let's take a quick look at the very top of the EPL standings. Manchester City and Leicester are at the top with 29 points each from 14 matches. Wayne Rooney's Manchester United, 1 point back with 28 points. And the Gunners of Arsenal have 27 points. Wayne Rooney, if you're tuning in tonight, David says you've been in abysmal form lately. So let's pick it up if you want those Red Devils of Man U to reach the top of the EPL standings. Wayne Rooney getting a little lashing this evening from David Legg in National Basketball Association news. Los Angeles Lakers superstar Kobe Bryant continues his farewell tour right here in Washington later Wednesday night. The Lakers will take on my beloved Washington Wizards at the Verizon Center Arena, located just a few blocks from our Voice of America headquarters. The Wizards are coming off a big 97-85 road victory over LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers on Tuesday night. It was probably the most magical victory of the season for the Wizards, who have been off to kind of a slow start, 7 victories and 8 defeats. All-star point guard John Wall produced his best game of the season for the Wizards with 35 points and 10 assists. LeBron led the Cavaliers with 24 points, and he also pulled down a game-high 13 rebounds. Getting back to 37-year-old Kobe Bryant, he announced earlier this week that this, his 20th NBA season, will be his last. Kobe received a hero's welcome in his hometown of Philadelphia on Tuesday night, but he and the Lakers couldn't beat the previously winless Philadelphia 76ers. With the spotlight on Kobe during the final game of his career in his hometown, the 76ers stole the show and beat the Lakers 103-91 for their first victory of the season. The 76ers had lost their first 18 games and 28 overall dating to last season, the longest losing streak in the history of major professional sports here in the United States. Kobe Bryant scored 20 points on Tuesday night. He walked off the court to a standing ovation and chants of "Kobe, Kobe!" Before the game, former Philadelphia star Julius Dr. J. Irving and Kobe's high school coach helped honor Kobe with some goodies and video highlights of Kobe's career. Kobe, right here in D.C. tonight. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, waiters at Latitude Cafe in Ibadan, Nigeria, with a new way to deliver food to the tables. And next, generating private sector interest in bringing new technologies to some of the world's most desperate people. But first, some music. Here is Manny Martin from Rwanda with Baba Nina.
Mema, sin nitosahau ulivyonihangaikia mama, pasipo msaada wa yeyote. Mama, ukihau kuna kule mateso tele, ili uninusuru na njaa, nikapata lishe, malezi na mavazi kwa jasho lako mama. Nilielimika, ulilinda na maradhi, ila sasa mama, wakati umewadia, swala moja nyeti nifahamishe mama, nifunulie siri na kusita, tafadhali nieleweshe. Mama, baba ni nani? Mama, baba ni nani? Nataka kumjua. Mama, baba ni nani? Mama, baba ni nani? Nataka kumjua. Nikiwa nikichelema sikutili ya maanani, umuhimu wa kujua ukweli kama nikiulizwa. Baba, mama, naomba nieleweshe, wala ni yule mwalimu aliyenifundisha shuleni. Baba ni nani mama? Baba ni nani? Ningemjua ningemwita mzazi akajibu mwanangu. Mama, baba ni nani? Mama, baba ni nani? Nataka kumjua. Mama, baba ni nani? Nataka kumjua. Nashaka kumumenya. Mama, baba ni nani? Mama, baba ni nani? Nataka kumjua. Mama, baba ni nani? Mama, baba ni nani? Nataka kumjua.
Manny Martin from Rwanda with Baba Ninani.
Well, waiters at Latitude Cafe in Ibadan, Nigeria, have found a new way to deliver food to the tables of their customers, so-called hoverboards. The motorized vehicles can be ridden much like skateboards or electric scooters. VOA's Esther Gitui reports.
It's a first in this West African country. In this southwest Nigerian cafe, waiters gracefully balance on two-wheeler hoverboards to ferry orders to hungry clients. Murakinyo Tight Bones is a consultant and the brains behind the Latitude Cafe and Lounge. He says the hoverboard has given the restaurant a business edge over competitors.
It's all about strategizing on your business. Not like I just want awareness for the business, like they just know there's a restaurant in the world that serves with hoverboards. And people just know, okay, let me go and check. And they leave and they don't come back. It's not like that. But when they come back, they get to experience the kind of services we render. You need an attraction for people to come in first. So when we get that kind of attraction, then people come in and they keep coming.
Hoverboards are gaining popularity fast in Nigeria and have become a growing trend worldwide. Oluwadamilare Tomi is a waiter at the Latitude Cafe and Lounge.
Sometimes, even, you know, on time, when this place is so crowded, you know, we can't use it. But they'll be like, no, I want you to use it. I want you to use it. Please attend to me. Even though attend to me, I'm not going to get it. So I'm like, okay, we're going to try. Because it really freaks them out using it, you know, to serve them. You know, they feel like, yeah, they are VIP, they're very special.
Nkiru Achikwu, a 27-year-old entrepreneur, started importing hoverboards after seeing their business potential in the Nigerian market. Depending on the size and the brand, one hoverboard can cost between $800 and $1,000. Some are equipped with blue underlights, Bluetooth, and music players that make them even more attractive to potential customers.
I think Nigerians are open to things like this, so I just brought in the first batch to test the market, and it was good, you know, so I just decided to, and so far so good. It's been amazing. I mean, I've even inspired some people to also start bringing in and selling as well.
With technology rapidly changing the world over, new ideas are popping up everywhere. Now hoverboards, which are similar to Segways, have found their place in the market. They are built without a pole and handlebars. They are self-balancing, and most can carry up to 200 pounds. Esther Gidoyuart, VOA News, Washington.
A new report claims that millions of dollars and thousands of lives could be saved by overhauling the way energy is provided to refugee camps. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, the researchers aim to generate private sector interest in bringing new technologies to some of the world's most desperate people.
The global displacement of people has reached its highest ever level. According to the United Nations, 59.5 million people have been forced to leave their homes. Refugee camps are swelling in size, and the resources to keep them running are often scarce. The newly formed Moving Energy Initiative, a collaboration between humanitarian organizations, is calling for an overhaul in the way energy is supplied and used in camps. Glada Lahn is from British policy group Chatham House, which is part of the initiative.
We believe there's huge opportunity to both improve the lives and livelihoods of these very vulnerable people and also help to save money over the long term.
The most recent electricity bill for Jordan's Za'atari camp on the Syrian border came to $8.7 million, forcing the UN to cut improvised connections. But 90% of people living in camps have no access to electricity. 80% rely on firewood for cooking.
Given more efficient cook stoves and solar lanterns, for instance, there could be a saving, we estimated, at $323 million per year, which would pay off the initial investment fairly quickly. There are even better solutions once you start involving solar or solar hybrid, mini-grids, other forms of renewable energy.
Researchers estimate that 20,000 refugees die prematurely every year due to the pollution from indoor fires for cooking. Gathering the fuel can also be dangerous, especially for women.
Women don't want to leave the tent or the hut at night time. If there's no lighting, when they do, they're at risk of accidents and also attacks. Similarly, we heard so many cases of women and girls leaving the camps to collect firewood and being at risk from rape and other types of attack.
Lahn says host countries are often reluctant to provide facilities that appear permanent, but researchers say that using green technologies could save lives and radically improve living standards for the world's most vulnerable people. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhim in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In the wake of the barbarous terrorist attacks by ISIL on Paris, Mali, Nigeria, and elsewhere, the resolve of the United States and its allies to defeat ISIL has intensified. In a recent briefing, Brett McGurk, special presidential envoy to the Global Coalition to Counter ISIL, explained how. We're going to suffocate the core, which is in Iraq and Syria, and we're going to suffocate the global networks. What is driving many of these foreign fighters to join ISIL in Iraq and Syria is this notion of the caliphate announced by ISIL leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in the summer of 2014. So primary goal, said Mr. McGurk, is to deprive ISIL of its territory. The U.S.-led military coalition against ISIL has been stepping up its attacks against terrorist targets in both Syria and Iraq. U.S. planes are now targeting ISIL oil trucks, in addition to their leaders, oil fields, and territory. On the ground, the U.S. is cooperating with local forces to launch a series of operations against ISIL. This effort has been quite successful, said Mr. McGurk, with the recapturing of the Syrian town of Al-Hal and territory further south. The Kurdish Peshmerga also played a critical role in recapturing the Iraqi city of Sinjar. The retaking of Sinjar is of particular strategic importance because it interrupts the Highway 47 corridor, which runs between Raqqa and Mosul. As Mr. McGurk put it, we want to isolate ISIL in Raqqa. We want to isolate them in Mosul and then continue to strangle and increase the pressure. That's going to continue. In addition, U.S. special forces are already on the ground in Iraq and now in Syria to assist indigenous forces fighting ISIL. With regard to defeating the global network of ISIL, there is a role to play for every country in the coalition. More than 40 countries have passed new laws aimed at halting the flow of foreign fighters. Some 34 countries have arrested foreign fighters or broken up cells and networks. As Special Presidential Envoy McGurk said, make no mistake, we're going to destroy this terrorist organization.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next, on Straight Talk Africa, after nearly 2 years of fighting the Ebola pandemic, Sierra Leone announced last month that the nation was Ebola-free. Guinean officials have declared that they will also soon be free of the virus. Join us Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss the battle to completely end Ebola in West Africa. That's next time on VOA Africa.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
Ebola is not a curse or spiritual infection. It is a deadly disease, a fever spread by contact with the body fluids of infected people. I am Dr. Conde Greaves. Symptoms start with a fever, fatigue, and muscle pain. Within a few days, vomiting and diarrhea sets in, and victims lose about 4 liters of body fluid each day. Ebola is highly infectious. If you experience any of these symptoms, seek medical help immediately. You must wash your hands regularly. Do not eat or handle bushmeat. Stay away from people suffering from Ebola. And do not handle the bodies of Ebola victims. If you have had contact with someone who has Ebola, you need to have your temperature monitored daily for any change. Early diagnosis and treatment is critical to your survival. Learn the facts about Ebola. Knowledge is life.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.